Anyway, good to see you all. So this week, yesterday, was Parshas Bo. This is like last week, this week, next week. It's just like history central. This is prime time. The Exodus from Egypt, all the plagues and what goes on. But tucked away at the very end of the parsha is a mitzvah we are all familiar with, but I would venture to say that there are certain aspects of it we don't really understand, or we've never even thought about it. At the very end of the parsha, it talks about the mitzvah of tefillin. Do you remember that? At the very end, it talks about the mitzvah of tefillin, putting on phylacteries. So I'm trusting, I shouldn't, but I'm trusting that you guys know the certainly the basics about tefillin. The Torah tells us, so what are they? So what are they? So tefillin are these black square boxes that we put on our arm and on our head, right? What's in it? What's in the box? You know, this is like, yeah, go ahead.
Sayings like from the Shema.
Okay. Well, how many sayings or paragraphs are there?
Four?
Is that a question or an answer?
Both.
You are correct. It's four. There are four paragraphs. One is directly the story of the Exodus. Two, the mitzvah of transmitting the traditions about it as well. Third is the first paragraph of Shema, and the fourth one is the second paragraph of Shema, both of which mention the mitzvah of tefillin. There are four paragraphs. Now, Irv, are they on one parchment?
No, there's four sections that they're tucked into.
You sure?
Think so.
In the headpiece.
Oh. So Rick wants to suggest that's only it's four separate compartments in the tefillin shel rosh, in the head tefillin. And you know that because it has, if you look at it, it actually has lines showing that there's actually dividers between them. There's three dividers creating four spaces. Each paragraph is written on a separate piece of parchment, as you said, tucked into its space. However, in the tefillin shel yad, in the arm tefillin, it's one scroll with the four paragraphs. Just as an aside, some of you may have heard that there's two versions of tefillin. There's what's known as Rashi's tefillin and that which is called Rabbeinu Tam. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Any Hasidic circles, especially Chabad, they're very particular to put on both sets of tefillin. Now, who Rashi we know? Rashi was the great commentary, right? Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, who lived around, he was born in 9 something and he died in 10 something, I forget what, about 1,000 years ago. Rashi, the famous commentary on Chumash, all of Tanakh, all of Talmud. I mean, it's like Rashi's the greatest, ever. Rabban Shel Yisrael, they say his acronym stands for. He had a grandson. His grandson was name was Yaakov, and he got the name Rabbeinu Tam, based on the verse in the Torah that says that our patriarch Yaakov, Jacob, was known as an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He was a I don't want to say simple, but Tam is a studious one who sat in the tents, as opposed to Esav, the hairy dude. So, as a nickname, he was called Rabbeinu, our teacher, our master, Tam, because his name was Yaakov. But he was Rashi's grandson. The difference between Rashi Tfilin and Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin is just the order of what the order of the four paragraphs are. Are they done in the order in which they're found in the Torah? Meaning sequentially. If it comes first in the written Torah, that goes first on the parchment or in its place? Or is it based on a different, based on association? That's the only real difference, minor differences, but that's the only big deal. But that's the machlokas, that's the disagreement between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Jokingly, when I was a kid, they would joke and say, well, We know many in many circles, the grandparents very often are feel honored that they can have a part to help purchase the tefillin for their grandchildren. So they jokingly say, "Which tefillin did Rashi buy for his grandson, Rabbeinu Tam?" But obviously, he got him Rashi tefillin, and then later on, Rabbeinu Tam did what he did. But okay, so there are four paragraphs, and as correctly pointed out, in the Arm Tefillin, it's one scroll rolled up is as one with one compartment in the Arm Tefillin. The Head Tefillin have four separate ones, each for one of those paragraphs. Now, what's interesting, a couple of observations. A lot of people don't know this. Your Arm Tefillin. What do you, many people, when they put it on, they cover it. Most of you probably do it anyway because it comes with a slip cover. Yeah, you remember that? That little one that actually has a little hole at the top? Some of you just leave it in your box. But you know what I'm talking about? There's a little. I knew I was going to get that funny look, so I brought my tefillin here. It's a good thing you guys don't watch this on Zoom too often, because I'll be like, why is he putting tefillin on at night? This is my arm tefillin, right? You'll see, unless you hold it here. See, there's no lines, Irv. You see?
Right.
It's just one box. But very often there's a little cover that sits over it.
Oh, okay.
Some people actually leave it on the whole time. Some make the bracha without it and then put it on. Some people, after it's on, they put their shirt sleeve over it. It's not just a funky thing, they don't want it to fall off. There's a reason for it. Your arm tefillin should be covered. It actually should be covered. Now, whether that little cover box is sufficient, I leave that up to you, but it should be covered. The head tefillin is completely exposed. Even when you want to put the talus over your head at certain points, the tefillin sits out. It's not a coincidence. There's a lesson to be learned. The arm tefillin versus the head tefillin. It's function of the arm tefillin versus the function of the head tefillin. Think about it for a moment. Why, I'll ask the basic question, why of all the places on the body do we wear tefillin specifically on the arm and the head?
Well,
I'm sorry?
on the head it says you shall wear it between your eyes, right?
Okay, you're right. The pasuk does say you shall bind it as a sign upon your arm,
And
and you
then
shall
the
wear it
coat.
as totafos between your eyes, which means above whatever I used to have as a hairline, right? That would be situated as if it were directly between the eyes. Good. And I don't disagree. That's what the Torah says. But let's delve deeper. What is the significance why the Torah says that we wear it specifically on the arm and the head? Come on, Mr. Ebner. It's right up your alley. It's like a meatball over the middle of the plate for you.
So those are like things that like you actually accomplish and work and do, and you need that, but you put it on your left hand because the right hand is more striking, you're fighting, and the left hand is weaker, isn't it? Something like that.
You're
I don't know, something like that.
throwing a lot of good stuff at the wall, and a lot of that stuff's gonna stick. But you're talking about the arm. How about the head? That's not accomplishing. That's your arm.
No, I mean, but the head drives the arm. The head is above the arm, so it drives the arm. It
So is your
drives
shoulder.
your shoulder.
Yeah, your
Well,
shoulder's above your arm, so put it on your shoulder and your arm.
okay. Well, I don't know, but your shoulder doesn't actually do work. I mean, because your arm
Really?
does work.
I
I mean,
pulled a
your arm.
muscle. One second, sweetie pie. One second. I pulled a muscle. My daughter's in PT school. She's thrilled that I hurt myself because she's like, "Oh, which muscle, Abba?" And she's pushing here and there. And I'm like, "Oh, stop. It hurts." Right? She tells me it's the, what she call it? The trapezius muscle. I said,
Wow.
"Gesundheit. What does that even mean?" She says, "No, there's a trapezius muscle that goes from your neck down to your shoulders and this." I said, "Well, whatever it is, it hurts. Stop pushing." So your shoulder does a lot of work. But you're not wrong. Mark, you're not wrong. Tell me what is the main organ in your head?
My brain.
Your brain. And what's in your brain?
Not much. I'm just kidding. A lot,
Yeah.
a lot, a lot. Not a hell of a lot. Okay, I'm
That's
just kidding. Not a hell of a lot. You'd be surprised. I was kidding. It's very sad. Very sad.
Okay,
Very sad.
for most people,
Yeah, right. Most people. Most people.
most people, what goes on in their brains are thoughts,
Right.
ideas, right?
Right.
I think if you boil it down,
Thinking.
the head, the brain, and your arm really represent the two most important functions of a human being. One is, as you correctly pointed out, the
Thought
driving
reaction.
force of what it is we want to do, either at that moment or in our life. It's got to come with a little seichel. It's got to come with a little thought process. You don't just do things. Animals just do. There's an instinct. They just do. They act on instinct, whether it's moral or immoral, it doesn't make a difference. We're supposed to use our brains. That's our thought. That's the control center. However, it's not enough to just live as a Jew in your head. It has to translate into arm, it has to translate into action. So your head represents thought, your arm represents action. I think that's pretty much the most basic understanding in terms of the tefillin. And what we're saying by wearing tefillin is that I am dedicating my thought processes of what I consider important, my priorities in life, and how that translates into real life, into real action. I dedicate that to Hashem, Torah, and mitzvos. That's, I think, the most basic, starting point when we talk about tefillin. Okay. Now, why would the arm be covered and the head tefillin revealed or exposed? Using this idea, what would you say? You hear my question? I'm taking it another step. I want to take it a step deeper. If the arm represents action, accomplishment, why would we cover it? As opposed to our head, our thoughts, our guide for life, that should stay open and revealed.
Because probably, we want action to be m maybe modified, lessened a bit, that we should really use our head more before we use our hands. We really should use our head first.
Okay, I like that. I like that idea. Let's build on that. What were you going to say, Jeff?
Nothing.
You look like you were going to say something.
No, I am don't like I gotta
Well, let
I
me
thought about
ask
a couple
you,
different things
let's
there.
build on that. Which is harder for a person to dedicate and to attribute to God? The thoughts, the ideas, or the action?
Action.
Why?
Because, I mean, you can dream all day long, but putting it into action is a whole nother level.
Good. And when you do the action and you are successful and accomplished, who do you think did it?
I
I mean,
share
no,
help
you
of them
don't.
with your
That's the
help.
challenge. That's the challenge. Your natural instinct is not to automatically attribute it to God. You say, I worked hard for this. It's so much easier to attribute it to yourself. It's fascinating. The Torah's terminology is kochi v'otzem yadi. It was my strength. It was the strength of my hand that accomplished and made me what it is. We attribute it. It's a natural instinct to think that we accomplished it. Perhaps that's the reason, Mark, you're correct, and that is we purposely put the tefillin on our weaker hand to remind us of that. If it's all me, I'm going to attribute it to my strong hand. Look what I did. We purposely, says the Torah, put it on your weaker hand because your weaker hand is not what normally would be the accomplishing. You were only able to accomplish it because you had help. The weaker hand normally can't do it on its own. So keep it covered. Don't think that it was all you. As opposed to the ideas, the idea of reflecting the concept of think about what goes on in our world. and you're bound to say there's a God here. It's much easier. The more you think, the more likely it is to attribute it to God. I'll show you. We've talked about this in the past. Paro. Paro was a genius. He really was. Not a nice guy, but a genius in his strategy. We come to the story of where Moshe and Aaron come to him for the first time, and they say, "Let my people go." And Paro's response is, "I don't know what you people are talking about, but you have way too much time on your hands to have these grandiose thing, these thoughts about leaving Egypt. Therefore, I'm going to make your life more miserable." Remember that? It was the end of not yesterday's Torah reading, but the week before. Yes, you vaguely remember that? Okay. What was going on? Till that point, Paro had supplied all the raw materials to make the bricks. He gave them the straw. He gave them whatever they needed, and they had to produce whatever the quota was. Now Moshe and Aaron come, and they say the Jewish people want to leave. So what does Paro do? He says, "That's it. Now you got to go out to the field and collect your own straw, collect your own raw materials. But I expect you to still do the same amount of quota, the same amount of work. Be as productive as before." Any businessman would scratch his head and say, "That's the stupidest thing possible. That's so dumb. If they are wasting time, or if they have more time, so then expect higher productivity. Why make them work harder for the same productivity? Just double the quota. Keep providing the raw materials. If they're producing 1,000 bricks a day." So now he's so upset and he says, "You know what I'm going to do? I still want 1,000 bricks, but I want you to go out and collect the raw materials to make the 1,000 bricks. Why? Give them the raw material and expect 2,000 bricks. So much more productive if you have extra time." But that's not what Paro does, because he's a genius. He doesn't care about productivity. He wants to keep them busy. Because if you're busy and you're walking around and working like a cockroach, you have no time to think. You can't contemplate. You can't even think about ideas of how you can do better and how your situation is so bad if you're working nonstop. You have no time to think. That's exactly what Pyro wants. He doesn't care about the productivity. He just wants to keep them busy so that they don't have these grandiose ideas. But if you take time to think, you're bound to come up with something that says, "I can be better. I can work on this. I can have more of a relationship. I can be more productive." Exactly what we should be doing. Therefore, there's no reason to cover. When it comes to your arm, action, and activity, yeah, cover it. Don't be such a hot shot. Don't think that it's all you. When it comes to thinking about things, think, contemplate, find time to see whether the direction you're going is really worthwhile. That's perhaps the difference why the hand is covered and the head tefillin are exposed. But there's another aspect about covering the arm, which I read a long time ago and I really loved it. You know, there's a bracha that we make every morning in Birchat HaShachar. It's very early on. We make a long list. Right? We thank Hashem for giving the rooster the seichel to tell the difference between night and day. And thank you for making me, you know, from not making me a non-Jew. And thank you for opening my eyes. And thank you for allowing me to stand. Right? All these different brachos that we make. One of them is very strange. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the Universe, sha'asa li kol tzarki. Remember that bracha?
Providing me with everything I need.
Providing me with everything that I need. On the surface, it makes perfect sense. We're thanking God that what I have is exactly what I need. If God wanted me to accomplish more, he'd give me more. This is what I need to do my best. But why is this the only one that's in the singular? Every other bracha is a generic global expression. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, pokeach ivrim, who opens the eyes of those that are blind. Not for opening my eyes. It's in third, like generic. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech haolam, zokeif kifufim, for straightening out those that are bent. Matir asurim, who free those that are bound. May it only continue with all the hostages. right? Well, we talk about it in that, but when it comes to my needs, I say it in the singular. Why the switch? Or have you ever wondered about that?
Well, I was thinking that maybe it's a mindset that whatever your situation is, God provides you with a way to address it. So it's.
Agreed. I agree. But isn't that true for everybody? Why can't I say, Sh Sha'asa lanu kol tzarkenu, that you provide for us all of our needs?
No, it's
Why
for
is
us to
this?
think. It's for us to think it out.
But isn't that true for everyone?
Well, yeah, individually, yeah.
Why does it have to be individually? Why can't it be in the plural? Because it's true for everybody.
Because you don't face the same kind of things in life that I face.
Okay. Go ahead. I think you're right, so close.
Okay, take me
You're
over
right there. I'll just add one
the
piece
line.
to it. Add one piece, and I think you'll love it. And that is, I never have the right to say you have everything you need. I can't say that. You can say it about yourself. But when it comes to me helping somebody, I can't turn around and say, hey, don't ask me for help. You have everything you need. No, chas v'shalom. No, heaven forbid. We don't do that. For me, I have every right and I should have the mindset that I have whatever I need. But if somebody needs help, I can't turn it around and have the chutzpah to say, how dare you ask? You have everything you need. No. You have to be cognizant. I can say that about myself, but I can't say that about someone else. Someone has needs, I'm there to help. That's it. Perhaps this is the second reason why we keep the arm tefillin covered. Because when it comes to my needs, hey, gotta keep that within my bounds. But that's for me. That's my thing. If someone else, I gotta do whatever it takes. Perhaps two insights about why the hand is covered and the head is revealed and exposed. But let's take this further. What is so special about tefillin in the first place? What do? We bind it on our arm. Right? That's really the mitzvah, is that when you're getting ready to do the binding of it, you make the bracha, and then you make that first binding. Some do it in, some do out, whatever, right? And then between the elbow and the wrist, what do?
Seven.
We wrap it around seven times, and then we do some finger roll, right? Everyone different customs. And we say something when we put it around our fingers. Anybody remember what?
They rustically alone.
Very good. What does that mean in English?
Don't know.
The Eirastich comes from the word Eirusin, which means to betroth, like engaged. The Eirastich li la'olam. You are betrothed to me, God says, forever. The Eirastich li betzedek uvamishpat, uvachesed uvarachamim. Betrothed to me with justice, kindness, with love. Right? We talk about this loving relationship. You know, in its most basic form, when we go around and we wrap the tefillin on our arm, it's like a reminder. You know, in the old days, before we had iPhones and everything else that we set timers and alarms for, right? We used to tie a little string on our finger to remind us, oh, right, don't forget, it's my wife's birthday. I better come home with flowers, right? We used to tie a little string. Going ahead, and or if you want to take it, we wear a ring. We wear a ring as a sign of our love and affection and our commitment to each other. That's what a ring says. When you gave your wife a ring, you said those exact words, Mark. You said, Hare at mekudeshet li, you are betrothed to me. Bitaba'atzu, with this ring, according to the laws of Moshe and Yisro. That's the sign and it's the symbol of our love for each other. Many, many people have a custom, either on the ketubah or at a ring afterwards, they engrave it with Ani l'dodi v'dodi li. I am for my beloved as my beloved is for me, because it's about a loving relationship. The Talmud says, what's found in our tefillin? Well, we talked about it. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We talk about the oneness of God. Asks the Talmud, what's in God's tefillin? It's a whole nother discussion exactly what that means, because God obviously has no physical body. But let's just go with it for now. It's an esoteric concept. But the Talmud wants to know if in our tefillin it says Shema Yisrael, which is talking about the oneness of God, what's in Hashem's tefillin? You know what the Talmud says? It quotes the verse, Mi ke'amcha Yisrael. Who is like my nation Yisrael? Goy echad ba'aretz. One unique nation in the world. We talk about the oneness, the uniqueness of God, and in God's tefillin, he talks about the oneness of us. Strange. This is what tefillin is all about, the loving relationship.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's all about. Binding this on our arm, binding it on ourselves, is putting a ring around our finger that says, this is my dedication for my loved one. I go ahead and I wrap it seven times. Think about a chuppah where you betrothed, right? Where you married your wife. How many times did she go around you? Seven times. The wrapping seven times on your arm is similar to the challah going around the chasen seven times. It's binding them as one unit, God and the Jewish people. Tefillin is, what do you mean it should be as a sign on your arm? A sign of what? The Torah itself doesn't say it. Right? All it says is, ukeshartam le'ot al yodecha. Bind it as a sign upon your arm, and letotafot as a commemoration, right, between your eyes. Of what? It doesn't state it explicitly, but I'm telling you, what it is a sign of the loving relationship between God and the Jewish people. I want to show you just how deep this goes. You may recall when we talked about the holiday of Pesach, right? In the Torah, how does God refer to the holiday as? What's the official name of Passover in the Torah?
Was it the matzah?
Very good. It's called Chag HaMatzot, the festival of matzah. And yet, in all of our liturgy, we in ourselves, just our regular day-to-day talk, we call it Pesach, Passover. The Torah never called it that. So I want to know who came along and decided to change the name of the holiday. Jeff, was it you?
Nope, but how come it says, doesn't it say Pesach offering?
Sure, but what's the name of the holiday? God
Well, I
didn't
mean,
call it.
Irv said it, and he's a
Yeah, it's
sharp
called in
guy.
the Torah, it's Chag HaMatzot. Yet we call it Chag HaPesach. So I want to know which rabbi came along and changed it up. What right do they have? Should we rename the holiday of Sukkot and call it I don't know,
Lulav?
call it Chag HaDilug, right? Because we go, oh, I don't know how you say hop in Hebrew, right? Because we do a sukkah hop. So it should be Chag HaHop. I mean, we can start making up new names of that. Who came along and called it Chag HaPesach now? That's a little chutzpah, don't you think? God called it Chag HaMatzot.
It because the Jews were passed over from
That is true, but that's not what God called it. God did it. God know he passed over the houses of the Jews.
Yeah, so who
Why
changed
isn't
it
it
to
called
that?
Chag HaMezuzah? Because they put the blood on the doorpost. I mean, you can pick whatever name you want once you're changing it from what God said, but who had the right to change it? Listen to an answer from one of the greatest Hasidic masters of all time, Reb Levi Yitzchak from the city of Bardichev. The Bardichev Rebbe, who's known as such a lover of the Jewish people, he said an amazing insight. He said, in a true relationship, you don't ask, what have you done for me lately? In a really strong, good, loving relationship, you always say, what can I do for you? You always recognize all the goodness that your spouse, that your friend, that your whatever puts forth for you. Not look at everything that I do. God forbid people who go for marriage counseling or divorce or whatever it is, and it happens. I'm not casting aspersions there, right? But the fact of the matter is that it breaks down. Neither one is recognizing as much as they used to the good that the other's doing for them, and all they see is what I'm doing for you, and you never recognize it, and you don't see it. And I do this, and I do that, and I do this, and I do that. In a real loving relationship, it's I recognize and appreciate all that you do for me. So now, let's plug that in to the holiday. God looks at the Jewish people. And he says, wow, what an amazing people I have. My nation is unbelievable. I told them it's time to go. And they said, but our dough isn't even finished yet. They didn't ask. They said, God said, go. We take it and we slap it on our backs and we're done. We don't wait for it to rise, right? Look at them. I told them what to do and they followed my instructions to a T. Wow. The Jewish people turn around and they say, what we did for you? Oh no, God, look at what you did for us. We are so grateful. You passed over our houses. You didn't strike any of us the night when you came through and wiped out all of the firstborn of the Egyptians. You saved us. We're so grateful and appreciative of what you did for us. So God, from his perspective, looks at it and says, wow. Mi ka'amcha Yisrael, who's like my one nation Israel? Chag HaMatzot. Ah, I love them dearly. Look, they went out when I told them to go and they didn't say, wait, my dough is still has to rise. I still got to finish cleaning and I'm not done vacuuming and setting the table and blah, blah, blah. God says, well, look at my people. And we say, what we? God, we owe everything to you. You passed over our houses. That's the honest truth. The relationship between God and the Jewish people is built on love. Therefore, when you talk about what's found in a tefillin, we talk about the oneness of God and in God's tefillin, which is the symbol of the love between us. In God's tefillin, it says, how amazing are my people, Israel. It's all about that loving relationship. Guys, do they? I don't remember anymore, but do they sing Anam Zemira in Shul by you guys at
Sure.
the end of Shabbos Musaf?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So this Shabbos, if you can remember for 6 days when you get to it next Shabbos, so pay attention. Most of us are already folding up our talis and catching up on the latest with our friends when it comes to this. But in the middle of Anam Zemira, such a great line. You have. It's for the letter, it goes, it's an acrostic according to the alphabet. It's another thing most people don't know. Okay? But here's what it is. The Chazan says, Pe'ero love. Sound familiar? The letter Pe, what it says is, his tefillin splendor is upon me, and my tefillin splendor is upon him, and he is near to me when I call to him. Before tonight, this made no sense to us. What do you mean? His tefillin splendor is on me, my tefillin splendor is on him. Like, what? Yeah. Because in this loving relationship, I keep God in my mind, he's in my tefillin, and we're in his tefillin. And therefore, when I call to him, he's near. Because that's what loving people do. Well, he'll come back to this in a second. Okay? This is one aspect, but there's more. When you put on your tefillin, what's the ordering? First, you put on your arm tefillin, then the head tefillin, correct? And then when you take it off, it's LIFO, last in, first out, take off the head tefillin, then the arm tefillin. I know we've spoken about that. We'll come back to it if we have time. But let me ask you, the halacha is very particular. The law is very specific. You need to minimize and not have an interruption between the putting on of the arm tefillin and the head tefillin. Meaning, you put on the arm tefillin, you shouldn't catch, oh, your friend walked in and say, hey, 1 second, Jack, I got to talk to you after davening. No. In between the arm tefillin and the head tefillin, no talking, no interruptions. Why? Okay, I mean, I get it. It's a mitzvah and you want to stay quiet, but. Is there a connection between the two? And if so, what?
Does it have to do with the concentration? Just to kind of compare it to during like the Shemona Esrei, we're not supposed to interrupt ourselves either. So it's
Good.
the concentration of our commitment to doing what we're doing at the moment.
Great. You're right, but let's take it and connect it to what we said. What does the arm tefillin represent? Action. The head tefillin? Thought, right? There needs to always be a connection between the two, a disconnect between the thoughts not translating into action, or, God forbid, actions without thought. That's not the way to go. There can't be an interruption. There needs to be a unity of mind and action. I say this all the time. I enjoy having conversations with people who love the intellectual pursuit of Judaism, and they appreciate that. But I question them, and I say, but where's the action? You can't just have the thought. It's got to translate. And then I get people who do a lot of things, and I ask them why, and they're like, I have no idea. I just do it. Neither one is correct. There needs to be a joint effort of thought and action, and vice versa. There needs to be action and understand with thought why we do what we do. Right? Does that not make sense? There can't be a disconnect between the two.
The question on the bracha. You know
Yes.
how like sometimes when we say a bracha, all it's not your dime, we have to keep quiet until we go and go over and break the bread and say a motzi.
Right.
You can't, and there's no interruption between the two. So
Right.
like when you say the first bracha on the arm tefillin, you say lahaniach tefillin.
Correct.
Does that bracha apply to the head one too? And is that part of the reason why you don't talk? Because until you put the head tefillin on and say all mitzvot tefillin, the bracha is not complete. Is it
But let me
something like
ask you, then
that as
why do you have a
well?
second bracha?
Well, that's why having a second bracha tells me one has nothing to do with the other. But I thought maybe each bracha has like a dual purpose.
Great. So Eric, you're right. You're spot on because it's a huge, huge machloket exactly whether tefillin is one mitzvah with two parts or it's really two separate. I'll show you where I'm coming from. You're right. The ordering is that before you tie it on the arm, you make one bracha, bracha tefillin, then you bind it, do it. Then, right before you press it down on your head, you make bracha da Hashem gam el cholam, shekhar shem zadonu, al mitzvat tefillin. Then you push it on, make sure it's right. But then, Eric, what do you say?
Gosh,
Baruch
oh, well, then you, well, then you do your
shem.
fingers and you.
Baruch shem kavod malchuto le'olam v'ed. Why are you saying that? When do you normally say that? And don't say by
Shema.
Shema. I knew you were going to say that. When would a person, when they make a bracha, when would they ever say right afterwards, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed? When they make a mistake, it's almost trying to negate what it is I just said, because you said God's name in vain. If let's say, for example, right, I think that I shouldn't, but let's say I think that in my bag, my lunch bag, I have an apple. And before I even put my hand in, thinking there's an apple in there, I made a bracha. I shouldn't do it that way. It's wrong. But before I put my hand in, I say, Bracha da Hashem gamel cholam, borei pri ha'etz, and I put my hand in, and lo and behold, there's no fruit. It's just a sandwich. So now what do I do?
Baruch Shem
Yes, you
Kavod.
immediately say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed, as if to try to negate my having said God's name in vain. So now, Eric, let me ask you, if I'm making a second bracha, why do I immediately say, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Le'olam Va'ed? Am I trying to negate what I just said?
You said there's a machlokas.
Okay, now I'm explaining to you why this is why we do it. It's two brachot, but it's not. It's two parts, but it's not. It's like we're caught in no man's land.
Yeah.
We're trying to do it as best as we can, according to as many opinions as we can. The Svardim, I believe, the Svardic Jews, they rule like the Rambam, and I believe they don't make that second bracha. I believe. I could be wrong, but I think that's the case. But that's but you're onto it because that's really it would seem that they're disconnected, but from the fact that we make the second bracha and almost quote unquote negate it by saying Baruch Shem, it's not really a second bracha. It's connected to the first one. So along those lines, we do have to keep the interruption to a minimum. That's really where that's coming from. In reference to your washing hands before Hamotzi, it's slightly different. It's a little bit different. What's the reason why I wash my hands in the first place before eating bread? Is it because my hands are dirty?
You're elevating. It's only till at your dime is you're elevating yourself.
Correct, but they're clean.
No, I'm spiritually.
Okay, so spiritually, why would I think that my hands are not spiritually clean right now?
Don't know. When we get up in the morning, we say it because we have like the death on our fingertips. We
Okay,
want to get the spiritual impurity off of our hands, and then, you know,
so I'm asking
so.
you 2 in the afternoon when you finally sit down to your Shabbos lunch after a long kiddush. Because you're stuffed, but you want to have a meal with your family. So you wash the tefillah yadayim again, and you make hamotzi. Why? You didn't have a shiluf. I mean, the chulent koma doesn't hit for another hour.
Maybe we weren't such a good boy that day.
Okay, what do you mean?
Avera. We did some Averas. We
And
had
that
time to
makes.
do them, don't we? Between the morning and the morning Olot and the time we eat.
So then we should be washing our hands all flipping day, baby.
All the time, yeah. I'd be washing nonstop.
You're right, but you're not. The hands are the most susceptible to becoming ritually impure, because if I touch certain parts of my body, right? Let's say, for example, I touch my shoes. Halachically speaking, if you tie your shoelaces, really you should wash your hands afterwards, especially if you're about to daven or you're in the middle of davening. You should wash your hands, okay? Because you're coming in contact with your shoes. Similarly, if for whatever the reason, I go ahead and I change, I get home from shul and I want to change out of my suit into something a little more comfortable. So I take it off and I want to reapply my deodorant. So I touch under my arms, not purposely, but I do. Hands are touchy. That's what they do. They touch things. It's likely that I've touched something in the course of my day that would render my hands ritually impure. Not physically. We're not talking about hygiene. But ritually impure, right? I scratched my head, right? It's another thing. If you scratch your head, right, you should wash your hands before you daven. These are things that would make your hands tame. So the real reason why I wash Netilat Yadayim is because it's the same way that the Kohanim would wash their hands and feet before doing the service. When we sit down to break bread, we are doing a service. So in order to remind ourselves of the way the Kohanim did the service, we imitate that. So we wash our hands. But technically speaking, Eric, as soon as I wash my hands and I make the bracha, I'm good to go. The problem is, if I talk, what happens is I've lost my concentration, like Irv said before. If I lose concentration, then where are my hands going to be? All over the place. I'm not paying attention. I pick this up. I put that up. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, my kid, my grandkid, all of a sudden, oh, I got to go change his diaper. Oh my gosh, hold on 1 second. And I change his diaper and your hands became tummy again. So, in order to keep us focused and not lose sight of the fact the reason we washed is because we're about to break bread and I want my hands to be purified spiritually, I try not to talk so that I stay focused. But technically speaking, I did the job. I washed my hands. I made a bracha. I'm done. My hands are pure. But I gotta stay focused. So therefore, we don't talk.
So if you, I thought it was a strict rule. If you talked, it's bye bye. It's you screwed up. So it sounds to me like there's a bit, little bit of a, open
There is, if you
opening
can
for
be
that.
certain, if you can be certain that, for example, let's just say for argument's sake, I sit down to the table and I can't move. I have my back, my what's it called? Trapezius muscle, right? It's bugging me. I can't get up again. And I recognize there's no salt at the table. Am I allowed to say, salt, please? Do I have to wash my hands in the tilat yadayim again for saying salt, please?
No, probably if you stay focused on the bread.
The answer is no, I do not. I'm allowed to say that. Why? Because it's germane to what it is I have to do. So, yeah, technically speaking, if you can stay focused and you said something that's not unrelated and you didn't catch up on the latest, news from OSU, in the latest basketball game or football game or the fact that we're still champs, woohoo, right? And you're talking about something, then I would say, okay, you don't have to wash again.
So if somebody like walks up to me as I'm walking from the basin to to the challah, and I can say to them, "Hold on, I just washed." I can say that.
You shouldn't. You should say, if it's somebody who doesn't know, let's say, like sometimes I have people who don't know about washing, right? So I'll try to indicate as best as I can, but I would rather not speak. If you don't have a choice, you say, hold on, I can't speak now, getting ready to break bread, I would say you don't have to wash again. How about that? My new phone number, 1-800 lenient.
Yeah, you're getting lenient on us.
Wow, it's the new Tuchman.
Oh my God. So progressive, this rabbi. Unbelievable.
Dam is going to break open now.
Just think you had mentioned before the connection between the head and the hand before I'm filling. And I just couldn't help but to think that my dad always said in Poland, all the Jews would always say, God forbid the person with the Jewish head and the goyish hand, that combination.
There you
He would
go.
always say that.
I bet you it comes from this concept
They would
that you
always say
think
that.
Jewishly, but it doesn't translate. I'll
Yeah.
bet you that's where it came from.
So interesting. Yeah.
Fabulous. Can I tell you, I actually quoted your father a couple of weeks
Really?
ago.
Really?
Yeah, he had such a real impact on me in many ways, but one thing stood out. We were at a kiddush. We were at a kiddush at Beth Jacob. I had davened at the kol that Shabbos morning, and I walked over for the end of davening to participate, whatever. I don't remember what the occasion was. And I guess I was there before the end of davening. And I was sitting with him. The davening had just ended, and they were getting the food ready. So he was sitting off to the side, and I sat next to him. And I talked and asked how he's doing, just making small talk. And then they opened up the buffet for people to come. So I said, come, we'll go get something. And he put, no, it's okay, it's okay. And I said, no, I don't mind. I continue schmoozing. No, it's okay, it's okay. I said, why? He was like, well, go get something. He looked me straight in the eye and he says, I don't stand in line for food anymore.
Interesting.
It was
Interesting.
like a knife through my heart.
Interesting. Interesting.
It was such a profound insight. Like, what am I rushing for? A piece of tuna fish? Another piece of cake? Like, this is what he understood, like, after going through his experience, right?
Right.
I don't stand in line for food anymore. And to this day, that is my perspective when it comes to everybody's
Wow.
rushing for a piece of this.
Wow.
I'm not waiting in line for this.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, it was no arrogance or anything. It was just as he
Unbelievable.
knew.
I'm telling you, Mark,
Right.
it was
That's
such
amazing. Amazing to hear that. Amazing.
a,
Amazing to hear that.
this must be, this has to be, one second. I'm already out of Columbus. How many years am I out? 18 years? No, I left in 08. What do we know? Yeah,
That's
16, 17 years.
wow, what impression. Wow, what
So this
impression.
had to be 20 something years ago.
Wow.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
You know something also, it's funny. I got his prayer book. So his prayer book looked like it was like dipped in water. And I'm like, what is this? So whenever he would daven, he would always have a glass of water next to him, just in case he would scratch himself or this or that. He would always put his hands in the water,
Right.
and then he would turn the pages, and there would be, so every page is like, this book is like, it looks like it was dipped in water, because through all the years and years and years of doing
This
it,
is the
or getting
reason.
something,
This is the
however,
reason.
Yeah,
I'm telling you, this is the reason.
That's unbelievable.
It really is. It really is amazing.
He had such a big effect on all of us.
Yeah, you really, unbelievable.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Very special individual. Really was.
Thank you.
Anyway, all right, let me share. Let me, what time is it? Oh, come on. How could it possibly be? All right, let me share two other insights. This one, everything I gave you now is tefillin 101. Now we're taking it to the graduate level. Now we're doing tefillin 401, this course, okay? One big jump here. The Torah tells us the following. The Torah says, V'ro'u kol amei ha'aretz, the other nations of the world will see, ki shem Hashem nikra alecha, that the name of God is called upon you. V'yaru mimecha, and they will have reverence for you. Talks about the fact that the way it should be is that the Jewish people should be that role model to the nations of the world. We live a life of that reflects values, that reflects spirituality and godliness, and the people see that and they have reverence and they fear us for that. I don't mean fear as in afraid, but there's a reverence. The Gemara says, what exactly does it mean that they will see that the name of God is upon us? Says the Gemara, Elu tefillin sheberosh. This is referring to the tefillin on the head. They'll see the tefillin on the head and they'll be like, wow. Really? That's what's gonna get them over the hump? Because they see us wearing a tefillin shel rosh? So there's different ideas about this, and I'm just gonna say it relatively quickly, but it's fascinating. Then the words Shem Hashem Nikra, the name of God is called, spells the acronym Shin Yud Nun. Shem, Hashem is obviously Yud Kei Vav Kei. Nikra starts with a Nun. So it's the letter Shin Yud Nun, which spells Shin. What's a Shin? It's a letter, isn't it? The letter Shin. Go ahead.
The letter on the...
Yeah, it's the letters that are on your tefillin shel rosh. Your Honor, exhibit B for the defense.
There it is.
See? It's all familiar, right? Watch, I'm going to do a magic trick. What does that one look like?
That must relate to the four pieces inside the head to fill in.
Strange. This side has a three-headed shin. This side has a four-headed shin. Raise your hand if you never noticed that before. Great. Now raise your hand and tell me why. Like, what's up with that? There's no shin that has what's four-headed. Okay, so the hour is late. I'll spare you. There's a general idea. All right, here we go. When Yaakov, our ancestor, our patriarch Jacob, meets Esav together with his family, the Torah, strangely enough, tells us that he bowed to Esav, which is unusual because we don't bow to people. And the commentaries wonder exactly what he was doing there. Why? But I want to focus for the moment. How many times did he bow to Esav? Anybody want to venture a guess?
Yeah.
How many?
Four times.
Four is a great guess, but wrong.
It's got to be three then. I mean,
nope. Try again.
One. Yes.
What?
Seven.
Seven is correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was gonna be my. That was gonna be my next.
You only have three choices, gentlemen. Seven times he bowed. Okay, why he does it? Again, there's a lot of commentary on this, but there's a general idea. When it comes to positivity, the way God created our universe, it's a yin-yang. We talk about this very often. There has to be a certain equilibrium. For us to have free choice about making moral decisions, there has to be a pull for the wanting to do the right thing, and there has to be at least an equal pull to want to do the wrong thing. if it was 99-1, it's not a fair choice. It's got to be at least close to 50-50. There has to be an allure to not do the right thing. Hence, the very first letter in the Torah is Bereshit with a Beis, the Bet, because our world is built on twos. Everything, it and its complement. I always quote this, right? The law of physics represents a truth in spirituality. For every action, there's an equal but opposite reaction. There has to be a give and take, a yin and yang. So if there's positivity, we'll call it the Yetzer HaTov, an inclination to do the right thing, there's obviously a pull for the Yetzer Hara, for the evil inclination, to divert us from what it is we're supposed to be doing. And there's tug of war. Yetzer HaTov wants us to do right. Yetzer Hara tries to convince us not to do that. And it's this back and forth, this tug of war, constantly within us to do the right thing. Anything that will exist in the realm of positive spirituality, there has to be at least an equal pull in the negative side, in the area of impurity. So if there's a certain koach of tahara, a certain power, strength of purity, there needs to be an equal koach of tumah, of koach of impurity, a strength of impurity. It's not a foreign concept to us. What the Jewish people, before they left Egypt, we famously say they were so low spiritually, they were on the blank level of impurity. 49th. And yet, in how many days did it take them when they left Egypt to get to the highest spirituality, to get to the Mount Sinai and get the Torah? They had reached it in 49 days, because they traversed those 49 levels to go to the 49 levels of purity. Okay, there's a yin-yang. It's got to be. So I'll just cut to the chase. The Yetzer Hara, the Talmud says, is identified by 7 different names. Because what that means, as we've said before, a name is not just a conventional wisdom of what you want to call something. It's a defining aspect. Your Hebrew name is your essence. That's why we're so particular about a Hebrew name. If God forbid, somebody is deathly ill, there's a concept of changing the person's name, of adding a name. Why? Because you want to change their essence. If there was, God forbid, a decree for somebody who's deathly ill, then you change his name, he's not that person anymore. That's the concept. It's not just voodoo, heebie-jeebie stuff. You're changing the essence. What?
How do you change?
There's a whole procedure. Talk to your LOR.
They did that to Franklin, my brother Franklin.
You know what an LOR is?
No,
local Orthodox rabbi. Come on. Okay.
Good one.
I don't know if I remember that, but it's happened in a few occasions I know of. Okay.
Franklin, my brother Franklin. They changed his name to Father Chaim.
And did he live longer?
Yes, much longer. 20 years.
There you go.
Unbelievable.
There you go. I'm telling you, this is not voodoo stuff. The essence of it is
and
changing the essence of a person. It's no longer this, now it's that. Okay. So the Yetzer Hara has 7 names. It has 7 aspects. It's a 7, if you want, 7 dimensional concept, 7 dimensional thing. It approaches it this way, has this essence, but it's 7 different parts to it. We know that from the positive side, 7 is always has a positive spiritual side. That's what Shabbos is all about, the 7th day. It's not just a different day, it's the 7th. It takes it and elevates the physical and infuses it with spirituality. So Yaakov bowing to Esav is a sense of, I'm going to take down your powers. I'm going to subjugate them. Okay, it's a long discussion, but just work with me here. If Esav, who represents impurity in the world, Yaakov bowing to him is taking that down, right? Similarly, when the nations of the world see that we're wearing tefillin, of which it has a 7 shin that has 7 heads, is representing taking down all the levels of impurity and going ahead and capitalizing with Hashem, so to say, the 7 positive, the seven spiritual aspects. It's interesting because the name Yaakov, where this comes from, is exactly seven times the numerical value, seven times of God's name. Yudke Vavke, 26 times 7 is 182, which is the exact numerical value of Yaakov. So we tap into this concept. So when it says that the nations of the world see that Hashem's name is upon us, which again I'm showing you is the letters Shin Yud Nun, spelling the name Shin, when they see the name Shin is upon us, representing the seven-headed shins, right? Seven combined, four and three. It represents our ability to take out the impurity of the world and bring the world to a level of seven positive, seven levels of spirituality. This is like, I'm not doing it justice, but I just want to whet your appetite that every aspect of wearing tefillin, from what it is to what's in it to how we bind it, where we place it on our arms and our head, there is so much symbolism. I'll end with this. Can you see what the name of this is?
Acupuncture.
Tefillin, an ancient acupuncture point prescription for mental clarity. This is an article, and it goes through every single point where we put our tefillin. The fact that it sits here, the fact that it sits there, it's wrapped around on the sides of the head, where it touches all the different acupuncture. This is from the Journal of Chinese Medicine in 2002. They identify that where the tefillin sits on the arm, on the muscle, and what points it touches all along on the fingers. This is the prescription for mental clarity. This is not another Jewish book. Tefillin is an amazingly potent mitzvah that allows us to tap into our relationship with Hashem. Remember, that's what this is all about, the loving relationship. And on the head, it gives you clarity of what's right, of how to go about doing it. In the old days, gentlemen, people used to wear their talis and tefillin all day when they would sit and learn. Why? Because it's all one. Nowadays, we're not at that level anymore. For us, we do the mitzvah. And that's great. That's wonderful. Keep doing it. But that's the concept. There's so much. It's like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, I think to Pac-Man, and when you eat that power pill, you can conquer anything. You can eat up all seven Pac-Man dragons, whatever those things are called. You can eat them up because this is packed. Tefillin is an amazing, amazing mitzvah. Okay, I've taken your time. Any questions?
No, but one quick thing.
Please.
Oh, so you know how like in Shanghai, before the war, and that those yeshivot or the yeshiva made it to Shanghai, it took them in, yeah. And maybe that's how China had the insight, like a God-given insight, to comment on the tefillin.
Could be.
I mean, where else would it come from? You know,
yeah, because it's a truth. That's why science. If it's a true scientific concept, it's rooted in truth. If it's real, it's found out. It has to be. All physical sciences, if they are rooted in the truth, will reflect a spiritual concept. It has to be. The two worlds, the physical world and the spiritual world, are tethered together. So if it's a truth, then it's a truth.
Yeah.
It doesn't shock me that you know, they found this concept. I believe it because I know it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Gentlemen, tomorrow morning when you put on tefillin, take 5 seconds before you put it on and say, okay, we're fulfilling this fabulous mitzvah. Hashem, give me the wisdom and understanding that I can get out of it everything that I possibly could. And then do it right. Make sure it sits in the right place. Make sure it's all, do it right.
Thank okay. you, Rabbi. Thank you.
Yeah,
Thank pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. call, thank you. Rabbi.
My pleasure. Great to see all of you.
Yeah, you too.
Good night.
Thank you.
Have a great night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
You too.